Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind?
If by old acquaintance you mean Ford Fairlane, then yes, forget that shit immediately.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome back, junkies, to the final Junk Food Cinema of 2014.
Oh, yes.
This is Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film cast that always resolves to be irony-free. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, New Year's baby of 1984. And I am joined by my friend and co-host, a man who eats evil for breakfast, novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
Is evil better with milk?
Evil gets soggy in milk.
That's true. I guess it would. Well, we are available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher if you want to hear more astute observations like that. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And we will also have a link to this week's movie up for Amazon. If you click on that link to get to Amazon, anything you buy benefits us, and we really do appreciate it. And you know what, Cargill? You've been saying it all throughout this series, and it's been wrong, so you can go ahead and say it now.
It's New Year's Eve, Paul.
I was thinking more like Happy New Year, because you've said that on the other shows.
Yeah.
Good. Set up, fail.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year! Woo! It's New Year. Let's make some resolutions. Our jaunt across the holiday horror calendar has finally brought us 2 years end, and that means it's time to make resolutions and prepare to party, because we're talking New Year's Evil. Oh my God, I'm so excited about this.
It is New Year's, baby. Can you believe it?
I can't. I can't believe we're already here.
I mean, as of New Year's, we are going to be as close to the year 2000 as we are to the year 2030.
Holy shit. My mind just
got
blown.
Let that sink in for a second.
So you're saying
that sink in.
You're saying we should throw our next New Year's party on a space station, is essentially what you're telling me.
Space Station 76, baby.
Space Station 76.
Oh, yeah.
So this movie we're talking about this week is
New Year's Eve Ball.
New Year's Eve Ball.
Let me do this.
Go for it.
This is one of Brian's favorite fucking movies to talk about.
It is.
This is a movie. I was there the night that Brian came home from seeing a screening of this at. It was at
the Alamo Ritz.
Yeah, it was at the Alamo Ritz, but it was one of the Terror Tuesdays, right?
It was, and I was in the fucking balcony. It was a beautiful experience.
And you just came home and you had your mind blown. And it was one of those moments. Like I've known you since you were, you know, a young film nerd, you know, coming to Austin to make it in the big time of high paid film critic world, and
just off the bus singing with a song in my heart and a suitcase in my hand,
and of course, you know, as we do, us critics go down to the bus station and pick up, you know, young pieces of ass to put on the street.
Cool
And I like where this but is no going. So I got to watch these moments where I would, you know, like one of my favorite moments with you was the first time you watched an Italian knockoff at my place at midnight after we did a Death Race 2000 and then after the fall of New York, and just you were like, what the fuck is knockoff Italian movies? And it's like, I'm going to show you a whole new world. And it's like we hopped on a magic carpet and we just, you know, a whole new world, junk food waiting to be seen.
That's true.
And just watching you go from that. And this was one of those moments, the night you came back from having seen New Year's Eve, you had this glazed look of euphoria on your face that you had discovered something amazing, and since named your New Year's Eve party every year New Year's Eve Ball.
Indeed. And we will get to some interesting situations from New Year's Eve, the party, momentarily. But
really? We're going to talk about Brian Four Loko Heads?
We're going to talk about it a little bit, at least for the four people who haven't heard that story already. So New Year's Eve is one of the more odd holiday horror theme. It was a situation where even by 1980, people were looking around going, what holidays are left? What holidays haven't been completely subverted by some kind of slasher film. What's still out there?
And at this point, we had not gotten the great Valentine's Day movie, as we discussed.
No, we had not.
And we had not gotten the great Father's Day movie.
No, we had not.
I don't think we even had April Fool's.
We did not have April Fool's. This is 1980. This is
them mining the early stuff. And it's like, well, fuck it, New Year's Eve.
On the one night they were celebrating New Year's Eve, he was out, ending their life.
So the basic plot of this movie is that it takes place during a big sort of live New Year's Eve concert event party.
That we assume is probably national, but has all the production value of local.
It has all the production value of a prom for lunatics, but they do have feeds coming in from, you know, this takes place in LA. They have feeds coming in from New York, Chicago, and Aspen, Colorado, because New York, Chicago, Aspen, sure, why not? So what they're going to do is they're going to ring in the new year in each time zone until they get to LA, and that's, you know, the final New Year's bell will be rung. And there is a woman whose name is Blaze.
Blaze.
And Blaze is sort of the sexy punk rock goddess who is a radio maven, except that she looks way too old to be any of those words.
That is true, but it's also funny because this movie is very punk rock and...
Sort of. It's very punk rock, and then when you look at the way what they think punk is fucking hysterical.
Except it's not punk.
It's not punk at all.
They keep calling it new wave. And it's not new wave either. It's like, it's closer to punk than it is new wave.
Yeah.
It has no idea. It's like, hey, what do the kids want? They're calling their music new wave and they look like this. And it's like, you haven't spent any time with anyone young because you've just kind of mashed together two subcultures that do not go together at all.
Kind of like new wave and old woman don't go together. And yet Blaze is still up there doing her thing. And during the course of the broadcast, somebody keeps calling in claiming to be, he just calls himself Evil, and he's speaking with a voice modulator. So he's just like,
I'm going to commit murder at midnight.
And he vows to kill one person for every time zone that hits midnight for New Year's. And then he's going to call in and basically play the recording of him killing them. And they got to figure out, who's this guy? How do we stop him? Eventually he's going to come for me. For some reason, he's an obsessed fan with Blaze. And there you have the basic structure of the movie. And then it does some very interesting things.
Now, before we go to the interesting things, I want to talk about how hard they lean on their premise and on their ideas.
Very hard.
The movie is called New Year's Evil. It's set on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, okay.
The party is called New Year's Evil.
Mm-hmm.
The first song played by the band on stage is New Year's Evil.
I am so glad you brought up that song.
And the guy who's calling in calls himself Evil.
And his resolution is to kill people.
Yes. So, I mean, this is, they lean, like, in the first 10 minutes, you're like, Jesus Christ, what else could you possibly do? Nothing more, because they really expended all their ideas.
Yeah.
And then the movie becomes exactly what you don't expect it to.
And it's funny, like, we talked last week about certain Silent Night, Deadly Night sequels that feel like they're not really connected to Christmas. No, fuck all that. There is no way this movie does not take place on New Year's Eve.
Oh, yeah.
They are fully immersed in their gimmick.
Yes. And now what this movie does that's interesting is you watch the first 10-15 minutes of this movie and you think you have an idea of where they're going and what they're doing. And then the movie is like, you know, all that setup, that's kind of the backstory, because we're going to follow the killer now.
Yeah.
And the killer is essentially the protagonist of the movie.
Yes.
And you're going to watch all the bullshit the killer has to go through to try to get this highly orchestrated murder spree out of his system.
Because usually these slasher films, they follow the victims for one of two reasons. Either because, you know, they want to make the killer a little bit more supernatural, or it really is a whodunit. It's more of a giallo, like, who's behind all this. We see the guy's face almost immediately. We see who he is.
But we have no idea.
But we don't get his name, or, you know, we don't really meet him. We just see his face. So
although, if you know anything about story and structure, you've figured out who he is within 10 minutes of watching it.
Sure, sure. But, you know, and then he goes around and he's carrying out his deeds, and he's living good. He's making good on his promises to kill people. And the first one actually goes very well. He, you know, he sneaks into a loony bin and murders one of the nurses that he's seducing, and then he gets the recording and he plays it, and people are freaking out, obviously. But I want to talk about the song for a second.
Let's talk about Gears 8 Ball. They're so happy about the song, they play it at the opening credits, and then 5 minutes later on the show, they play it again.
Yes, yes, they play it, that glorious party at the Holiday Inn.
This glorious party at the hotel that's supposedly being broadcast nationwide, that only has two bands playing, and yes, you can't actually tell the difference between the two bands.
No, you can't tell the difference at all. But that song, it's by a band called Shadow. And I really fucking unabashedly love that song. I think it's really dopey, and it's not technically very magical, good. But it's we're good. But it's really catchy and does rock to the appropriate level of hard. I really have a lot of fun. And every time I hear that song, maybe it's the association I have with the movie, but it just makes me so happy. It makes me happy to think of the movie. It makes me happy to remember if I'm listening to that song, then it's probably coming up on New Year's and it's time to get fucking twisted shit-faced and do crazy things. Because one of the things about the party is she says, you know, everybody's going to make their resolutions tomorrow, so tonight we're going to let our evil sides out. That's why the party's called New Year's Evil. And I'm like, you know what? I like that. Except that I'm going to leave off the second part, too. But I'm going to do the first part where you go evil and you go crazy. But the whole resolution thing, I don't really think I need to do that. So I'll just do the first part. But I really like that song. It really, like I said, it's not a great song. It's not even a good song. But it's very catchy and it's lot of fun.
And it's very of its time.
It is extremely of its time.
And then we get to the movie.
Yes, the movie itself.
So here's one of the chief issues with the movie.
Okay.
Is that there isn't a likable character in the goddamn thing. Like, everyone is just shitty. Even the characters, like, you know, Blaze is a self-absorbed narcissist. Mm-hmm. And who, you know, her son shows up and has this really big news and has showed up on her big night with flowers and says, "Hey, Mom, I got this part." And she's not even paying attention, and she's so wrapped up in what she's doing.
She's busy making her cheekbones look even sharper than Muriel Hemingway's.
Yeah, and so you're like, well, how, she can't be the protagonist, I don't like her. Well, what about this kid? Well, then the kid becomes a little whiny bitch, and like he does not get his mother's approval, and so he becomes just so whiny about it and goes and pops some pills and starts doing weird shit that arguably is exactly the kind of weird shit you do when you're on drugs.
Well, and he exists in the movie, I feel, to be the red herring. He's there to make you think, oh, obviously he's involved in this somehow, which is odd because we see the face of the actual killer, but we keep thinking that something's going to happen with his son because he's like cutting up pantyhose and putting them on his head. And I got to say, actually, one of the more visually interesting things about this movie is his sort of like, his descent into lunacy is so wackadoo that you kind of can't stop looking at it. And that's, to me, one of the more visually interesting things about the movie. Yeah.
Then the cops show up when the call comes in, and the cops are fucking dicks.
The cops are such dicks. The cops actually say to her, "You people, you create the problem," and then you complain about it. I'm like, I'm gonna stop you right there. I'm not sure what "you people" means, and I'm not playing a race card here where people are like, "What do you mean, you people?" I literally don't know what you mean, because she's an elderly, new wave / punk.
She's in her 30s, dude.
I'm sorry. For this role, for the part she's playing, the clothes she's wearing, the makeup, she's way too old for this shit. She is the Danny Glover of this movie and doesn't even know it. But it's like, what about her? What is her people exactly? And what problem have they created?
Again, that goes back to the weirdness of, essentially, this is supposed to be the punk scene, but it's, everyone looks like punks, but they're not punks. And they're supposed to be new wave, but nothing sounds or looks new wave at all. Like, it's very, like, they've created this subculture that doesn't actually exist. And they're supposed to be, you know, you know, violent and asshole. Well, and we see that in the opening credits. Yes, sequence.
The opening group that's coming to the party is pure punk. Is absolutely like fuck the world. Wearing the leather, wearing the dog collars,
we're
flipping
hitting
people
each
off.
Other for no apparent reason.
They are absolutely punk, or at least what we could accept in a movie like this to be pure punk. And then once they get into this party, it becomes this weird porridge of just people that wandered in off the street.
That is the second like fatal flaw of this movie is that say what you will about anything else that goes on in the movie, the direction, the writing, anything else. The one thing this movie totally fucks up on is all of its extras casting and its supporting cast are amongst the worst and weirdest performances you've ever seen. There is one small 3-second scene in a liquor store that is one of the most uncomfortably weird, strange shots you've ever seen.
Have a happy new year.
It looks like they've just had a big talk and a cry.
Yeah, he's going to reach out and be like, it's going to be all right. It's not your fault. He's going to Robin Williams her any second.
Yeah, no, and it's just so weird. Like, there's no reason. Like, it's literally the scene is, okay, she's just bought a bottle of champagne and you're giving her her change back and wishing her a happy new year. That's the scene.
That's all you got to do,
and
man.
They milk so much weird emotion out of it. It's like, dude, that guy's fucking either creepy or they just had a moment that got excised out of this movie.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that the only black guy we see in this entire movie? I'm pretty sure that's the only black guy we see in the entire movie.
It's possible.
He just has this moment where he's like, hey, happy new year. It's just what?
I mean, I don't know.
What's happening here?
There's actually a character in this movie that exists entirely in ADR.
Oh, that's right. No. It's not the only black person in this movie because the first black person in this movie is literally the first person to die in the horror movie. Like, completely upholding the cliche.
Yes, she bites it in the first scene. Then we have the credit sequence. There's a character in this movie that's entirely ADR. Have you ever noticed that?
A character in the movie
who's
entirely ADR.
That there's a scene where the killer is like chasing someone, and then we hear this voice.
Oh, that's right.
Like,
there's
this entire character that has like 3 lines of dialogue in the movie.
Yeah.
Never appears on film. Like, it's an entirely ADR performance.
Yeah.
This movie is just riddled with these very weird, like, actors who cannot in any way, shape, or form act and create these weird moments that you're like, I don't know what the fuck I'm watching right now because this character's performance makes no fucking sense.
And I will give you, there are filmmaking flaws that lead to scenes that make no sense. And then there are things that I think are absolutely intentional humor that work almost as a send-up of the genre, like something like, you know, if you've ever watched like Student Bodies, like there are moments in this film, like one of the great ones for me is there's a scene where we have, again, we're talking about this weirdo mosh pit that's going on at this party and this complete amalgam of people that would never actually hang out or go to the same venue. And there's this great scene where the dancing they're doing isn't even really fully moshing.
It's a zombie shuffle.
Yeah. And they cut, there's the TV, like, you know, broadcasting it, and they cut from the TV of these people doing this awful dance into the, like, the rec room of an asylum, and the inmates are doing the exact same thing, which is such an intentional joke. It reminds me a lot of Alone in the Dark, Jack Shoulders Alone in the Dark, where at the end of the movie, Jack Palance, who's an escaped mental patient, wanders into a new wave club and looks around like, oh, wow, I'm home. Like, these people are all insane, too. It's like that level of parody, of complete satire, and it really works. And then there's also the whole thing about, I mentioned the first kill goes really well for Mr. Evil, but the second kill goes so comically bad that you can't help but think that it was intentional. Like, he has this whole, like, character that he's made, like, I'm suave business agent to the stars, and I'm going to lure this girl out of the bar. And it works until she's like, oh, I'm going to bring my roommate with me. And he's like, okay. And then as he's driving around trying to figure out how he's going to kill 2 people instead of 1, she's just yak, yak, yak in his ear about, like, transcendental meditation. And he realizes she's the most annoying person on the planet.
Yes. Oh, and yeah, it's... Now, first of all, of course, that's first the person you're going to get to come with you to Eric Estrada's party.
Eric Estrada's party. That's what he's taking her to.
He's taking her to Eric Estrada's party.
He takes an even dumber Lonnie Anderson to Eric Estrada's party, or at least that's the cover. And then he has to figure out how to kill both of them.
And she brings the friend, and it's like, oh, you just pulled that shit on me.
Yeah.
Because it's, I mean, the thing is they're making fun of, you know, the there's a lot of fun in that scene being poked at the dying disco culture. And that's one of the like smartest things about the movie, that you're watching it, and from one aspect you can look at it and go, oh, this is kind of shitty production value. This place looks kind of sad and lonely. And I'm like, this is 1980. They're trying to make the disco look sad and lonely. They're talking about what's happening to the discos. That's kind of cool. No, but this is where the movie gets interesting for me, because, you know, when, you know, we watch the first kill and we watch the setup, and it's a little, you know, it's like the girl gets killed, but what the fuck? That's and like it's classic. Largely, you walked in, some strange guy shows up, claims to be, you know,
a doctor
coming to work the shift that you've never heard of before and you never heard was coming over. And he's like, hey, I brought champagne. Can we slip off and have a drink? Oh, sure. We're going to make out. Hey, let me take your shirt off. That you're moving a little fast. It's like, does it really matter tonight? No. So all
she actually fucking says that.
She actually says that. So 10 minutes into knowing this guy, she's going to bone this stranger who showed up. Okay. Yeah, when she gets killed, you can't feel too terrible for her.
And yet the movie does. And yet the movie does, because they kill her off screen.
Yes.
She's one of the few people in the movie whose entire murder is off screen.
And it's one of the cheesier murders, because it's literally, you see the hand, and the hand goes off screen, and it comes back with blood on it, and we cut away.
That's the old Giallo trick, man.
Yeah, yeah. But once you get to the second kill, and you start seeing all the complications that this guy runs into, he's having a bad night trying to get... He's set himself this ambitious goal of, I'm going to kill a stranger. In fact, he actually lies. I mean, that's one of the things that disappoints me about the movie is he says, I'm going to kill somebody close to you.
And he did at the beginning of the movie, but she's not one of the victims that
was
that
That was after he'd already done it, so...
No. It was before he had even called into the show.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Okay, when he said, I'm going to kill somebody, he never does. He just starts killing random people. And the first one makes sense. And then from that point on,
think about it this way. He was probably planning on doing exactly that. But one of the things that I find really interesting about this movie is how Murphy's Law it is, even for the killer. Like, the killer is not above above Murphy's Law.
And that's
like,
what
he falls prey to the same, circumstances of anybody trying to do anything. Like, there are just certain things that are going to be out of your control. And I think the moment that solidifies that is that after he barely accomplishes killing the girl and her roommate from the bar, and he has to pull some real, like, dopey shit to do that, he runs afoul of a biker gang that then tries to kill him.
Yeah.
It's like this completely, like, it's like Pee-wee's Big Adventure at that point. They chase him into this drive-in theater, and he's, like, trying to hide from a biker gang. He's the killer of the movie, and he's hiding from people. Yes,
and that's what's fascinating about this film. The tension, the biggest tension of that, the biggest tension I feel in this film is, will he or will he not be able to kill those two girls?
And you kind of root for him to do it.
Yeah, because it's a very weird movie in that way. But then we get to the drive-in theater, and we meet the only redeemable character in the fucking movie.
True.
She is a teenage girl who's getting high in the back seat of a car with her boyfriend, letting her boyfriend feel her up and kiss on her breasts, and he wants to do it, and she's like, maybe the next movie.
That's why I respect her so fucking much. She's like, no, this movie's good. We'll wait till the next one. She's awesome.
She's into what she's watching, and then the killer gets into the car, throws him out, drives off. And, you know, that's the moment where my wife is like, why did she get out of the car? And my wife had just walked in at that point, and she starts doing what she does sometimes, where she starts, like, when she knows I'm watching kind of a cheesy slasher, she's like, this doesn't make any sense. It's like, well, 2 minutes ago, she was almost topless and puffing a joint in the back seat of the car. She's like, all right, okay, that makes sense. Yeah. Like, that she's trying to, but that's why she's buttoning up. Because she had the whole logic thing of, you jump out of the car naked when somebody tries to steal your car with a knife. And it's like, yeah,
she's high
as fuck right now.
Which leads her to make an offer that is so...
That is, but it's...
I mean, it's logical.
It's logical, and the thing is it's so innocent, where she's just like, we can get it on if you want, just don't hurt me.
Yeah.
And it's... And then she's redeemable, which is why she's the one character that gets away scot-free in this
movie. And this is, I think, the greatness of the way this is structured, is that you're disappointed. You're disappointed that he didn't achieve his goal. You like her. She's redeemable.
Yeah.
You're glad she got away. But at the same time, you're like, oh, now he's not going to get
because
to achieve his mission.
Because at this point, you've actually... This is why this movie's worth talking about. Because the killer you're actually interested in him. And this is the one thing I think is truly the real strength of the movie, is the performance
of Kip Niven.
Of Kip Niven, who really does seem like that charming, good-looking bastard who could lure women to their death.
He's Ted Bundy. He's absolutely, he's not disheveled Night Stalker Richard Ramirez. No. He is Ted fucking Bundy.
He's Ted Bundy. And it's executed so well. The way he skillfully picks up that pinhead blonde from the, you know, it's like, hey, do you have the time? Yeah, it seems the more expensive they get, the
Which is just, in my opinion, one step up from, you look at the time and you're just flexing your muscles while you look at it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's douchey, but it's exactly the type of douchey thing that you did in a fucking disco club in the fucking, in late 70s, true, early 80s.
And it rings her bell.
In LA. Yeah. And so it, but of course, he's exactly the type of sleazeball that causes her to bring her friend along. It's like, hey, I'm going to this party. You need to come with me because I don't know this guy. And leads to that. So yeah, watching the dominoes fall, and this is where it goes down, where these bikers are like tracking him down and like chasing him all over the place. And the bikers are kind of smart for what they're doing. They're assholes, but they're smart.
Yeah.
And, but you hate the bikers.
You do.
And that's the other thing, is that, again, no one is fucking redeemable in this movie. When your crazed killer, who they have not revealed any of his fucking motivation, why he's doing it or who he is, and you like him more than anyone else in the movie, you failed to connect us to any of the characters in your film, which yes, feels almost intentional.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. This movie, like, there's so many, you know, going back to the humor for a second, I want to go back to this mosh pit, this weird party, this
zombie shovel.
I think the situation is best summed up by Zach Carlson in his book Destroy All Movies: The Complete Guide to Punks on Film. He fucking nails it. He said, "The main attraction here is the concert, which has attracted all varieties of madcap rejects, despite the fact that it seems to have been booked in a Holiday Inn banquet hall. Though the bulk of the revelers are standard New Wave warriors, one standout attendee is a fat middle-aged man with his arms encased in bubble wrap sheaths." There is no congruity whatsoever to this group of people. No,
there's really not.
Or what they're doing or anything, to the point that, like I said before, I think this is a send-up of, you know, this burgeoning sort of like, and even sending up anti-disco, like it's sending up the next wave of music, like, you're all ridiculous. You have people who have like leather and dog collars. You have people with fluorescent sport coats and sunglasses. You have people with trucker hats and sleeveless shirts. It's like, where the fuck did you get these people?
But it's also a movie that seems to hate LA.
Really fucking hates LA.
It really hates LA. And it doesn't, it's not heavy-handed with it, but when you're paying attention to what's going on, it does not try to ever capture the beauty of Los Angeles.
No.
It always makes it look ugly and dirty, and everyone in it is a fucking asshole or a stuck-up fucking prick.
And they go out of their way to make sure you know it's in L.A. Like, if there's little moments that if they weren't there, they could have said this movie took place. Obviously, she says, you know, we're on the West Coast. And then he specifically calls the cops and gives them the exact cross street locations where they can find the body. And it's like Figueroa and Laurel Canyon. It's like, okay, yeah, this is a movie that wants you to know this is L.A.
Yeah.
And yet, with all of the big hotels out in L.A., with all the fancy venues, it's in a fucking Holiday Inn.
Who hosts New Year's Evil? I mean, honestly.
Who rules Bartertown? What did
exactly,
you ask me?
Exactly, yes. I mean, that's just
very
like,
confused here.
Hey, hi, yeah, we're going to book a national, yeah, we would like to shoot a national television show on New Year's Eve from your hotel. Oh, what's it called? No, no, no. It's not Dick Clark's. It's New Year's Evil. Hello?
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 Oh.
No, it's like, no. It's like, who's hosting it, Elvira? No, Blaze. She's like Elvira, except not as hot or as cool or as knowledgeable about film.
Nor will she be as relevant in 6 months. You know, I want to go back and talk a little bit more about the killer, because he's on this whole murder agenda that at first seems totally random. So he is just going around looking like a sleazier version of Bruce Jenner, and
he does. That's what was fucking with me the whole movie.
Doesn't he look like Bruce Jenner?
I know it's not Bruce Jenner because Bruce Jenner's only appeared in two films, and both films have won the Razzie. But
especially with that mustache, you know what he looks like? If Bruce Jenner had a younger brother that was a Fredo, if Bruce Jenner had his own Fredo, that's who this guy would look like to a T. That's exactly who he is. But the big twist at the end. You know, and this is another Spoiler alert.
Dun, dun, dun.
It's Blaze's husband who is mentioned because he gets mentioned once at the beginning of the movie as a throwaway, so just you know it's going to be him.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about it is that in any other movie, in any other slasher film, it would have been, you never see his face, he's wearing a mask, which he's only, by the way, he wears a mask once in the whole movie, and it has nothing to do with murdering anybody.
Except I would argue that's the single greatest production choice in the thing. It's like, why? The minute that showed up, I'm like, why the fuck has he been killing people in this mask all along? That mask is creepy as fuck.
It is. It's a church carnival Oliver Hardy mask. Like, it's an Oliver Hardy mask if somebody really fucked up Oliver Hardy's face.
So creepy.
And that mask he's wearing in the one scene where he's not actually killing anybody.
Well, he wears it in two scenes.
He wears... Oh, yeah, you're right. But in the first time we see him in it, it looks like he's about to kill Blaze. And it's like, oh, haha, surprise, it's me, I'm here for your big night. And it's like, oh great. And you're like, holy shit, he's been doing this the whole time. For what reason? Like, he's fucking mad about something, but he's still with her. This is a completely different reveal, a completely different spin on the structure of a slasher movie. Like, this shit, you know, maybe you could argue that there are you know, it's beholden to certain thrillers that have kind of done a twist like this, but in a slasher structure, in a slasher format, this kind of thing doesn't happen. And it was really interesting to me the way that they do that reveal. So it's like New Year's Evil is as much a standard slasher as it isn't at all a standard slasher. And I mean, it's gory, it's got the fun kills, it's got a themed killer, but it's also about a very troubled family completely falling apart and how the father feels completely emasculated by the mother's success and what that's driven him to do.
And then the movie goes full retard. And everything, it goes off the rails in so many great ways and so many terrible ways. It makes the worst logic decision I've seen in one of these films in quite some time.
Like, okay.
It's one of those logic things that just makes you angry. It's like,
well, clearly it makes you angry.
Well, here's something that can really, to the screenwriter's credit, to the director's credit, whoever really shepherded this film, they worked really hard to try to make every element of this film make sense. Like, every decision that people make, they set up at least 30 seconds before it happens so that there's a logical reason so you're not asking questions like, well, why are they doing that? They try to explain everything away. They try to make characters act intelligently. And then the husband, who has just snuck into the hotel, has jumped out and booed at his wife, and they're like, oh, this is great. And he walks out of the hotel room, and the cop that has just been posted there is like, where did you come from? And he's like, I was
in the bathroom.
I was in the room. And he's like, yeah, but this hotel's been on lockdown. And it's been on lockdown for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Where did you come from in this giant fucking hotel? How the fuck did you get into a room that I didn't clear out first?
Yeah.
How did, you know, and this, you know, not only is that the dumbest question ever, the killer then goes, well, I cleared it with the manager. Oh, you mean a verifiable bit of information that I can make a call on my walkie-talkie? Okay. It's like, this guy has been smart this whole time and just doesn't say, oh, I've been hiding in the hotel room for hours waiting to surprise my wife and she hasn't come back, but I've been here all along. I got in long before you guys closed this place down. When did you close it down? I've been up here. What the fuck's going on? None of that. Nothing that actually makes sense. We do this and have this stupid logic jump so that we can clue all the other characters in who the killer is.
Well, but see, here's the thing. The thing that I like about that is the rest of the movie, it doesn't make sense logically. It does kind of fit in with what's been going on in the movie, because it seems like if he had a master plan at one point, it was going well for about 20 minutes and then just completely fell apart.
Went well for an hour and 45 minutes.
But then completely, epically fell apart. Yes. So frankly, to me, that's just like the icing on the shit cake that was his failed plan. It's just like, I don't know, manager, sure. I cleared it with a manager.
I'm about to jump off the roof, so who gives a shit?
Jump off the roof while quoting Shakespeare. That is my favorite moment of the entire film, is that nobody even gets to kill the guy. He fucking takes his own life like a goddamn samurai, and right before he jumps off the roof, wearing his Oliver Hardy mask, he starts quoting, I think it's Hamlet, that he starts just spouting off lines. Like, did we establish at any point that he was an actor?
Nope.
Because he seems to really love... His son is the actor. They established that the reason his son is pissed off and doing crazy pantyhose head is that he's mad that his mom didn't give him any kind of props for getting this big lead. And I love the whole...
Do you know on the name of the show? American Starship.
American Starship. We built this TV. We built this TV with terrible shows. But yeah, so he's like, the whole speech about, like, you know, he didn't even tell people he was your daughter. He got that all on his own. I'm like, how famous can she possibly be outside of this, like, 3-block radius?
Yeah. Yeah,
but there's no way.
But so we've talked about a few of the full retard elements. We haven't gotten to where this movie gets really, truly, unrepentantly stupid.
Which is?
The elevator kills. When he starts playing around with the elevators inexplicably and using the elevators to disorient the characters that are in the elevator.
He hangs Blaze from the bottom of an elevator and just has it keep going up and down, which makes me laugh every single time. She's just dangling from the bottom of the elevator.
A stuntman is dangling from the bottom of the
elevator. A stuntman wearing like a vinyl onesie to look like Blaze is dangling like a human pinata off the bottom of the elevator, just going up and down, up and down. And
I'm sorry, fucking
hilarious.
That's why she has the costume change. She has this inexplicable costume change towards the end of her show, and it's like, I'm telling you, it's because that was a dude hanging from the bottom of that thing, and he was like, if we do this and we shoot up the way you're looking at, you're going to be looking up at my scrot.
That's true. I want to talk for just a moment about what's oddly prescient about this whole movie, is that it sort of portends the rise and fall of MTV. Now, you have to remember, this movie came out in December of 1980. MTV launched in August.
Just before New Year's Eve.
And 8 months prior to the launch of MTV in 1981. And
which was 5 months before the launch of Night Flight, which was 3 months before MTV launched.
And Kevin Bacon somehow. But what was
Night Flight was the first show on television to show music videos. No,
I know. I know you've been beating the Night Flight drum.
Like, I love Night Flight.
It's like you're getting kickbacks from that channel that doesn't exist anymore. It's very strange.
Ooh.
the channel
exists. The show has been gone.
What we're essentially talking about in this movie is we're watching a prototype of MTV's New Year's Rockin' Eve with a sexy VJ before VJ was even a thing that existed.
Yes.
But the problem is that she's a little too old to keep pretending that she's hip and in touch with youth culture, as demonstrated by her completely schizo demographic audience.
Is her name Martha?
No, she's the Kurt Loder of her time.
You're really going to go Kurt Loder and not Martha Quinn?
I'm sorry, Kurt Loder was the oldest person on MTV by at least 20 years, for 20 years.
Yeah, but the thing is he was always seemed bitter about it.
Yeah, he was always bitter about it.
I'm Kurt Loder, and I'm going to read news about people I don't give a shit about.
She was okay. So Blaze is like downtown and then back again, Julie Brown. If that was a thing, if it was downtown and back again, Julie Brown.
She downtown Julie Brown does do 80s and 90s shows on the Sirius Network.
That's true. She does.
She does.
Oh my goodness.
They're the saddest ones too, because she goes to play a song and then she tells a story about meeting someone at a party or at a junket 20 years ago. And it's like, oh, I got the pleasure to meet this person at a junket. Never tells an interesting anecdote about it. But hey, I got to meet this person.
Which sadly sounds like a lot of people I know, and probably myself included. Oh, bloggers. We're just like VJs.
Oh, we are the VJs of this generation.
We're the nerdiest VJs imaginable.
And we're very sorry about that.
But despite all of its flaws, yes, it's an absolutely wretchedly, you know, for the most part, written film. But it does enough interesting things within the slasher genre to make it worth watching. And even the silliest parts of this movie are entertaining. And to me, that's exactly the kind of thing that I look for in a movie like this. Can you at least make it a fun watch? And for me, that's exactly what New Year's Evil is. Even at its weakest moments, it is a very entertaining slasher film. It absolutely, at points, is being downright satirical. There's some really good performances in it. The song is a lot of fun. Like, there's so many elements of this movie that make it work, and make it work maybe specifically for a person like me. Well, that's fine. I'll own up to that.
Well, and say what you will, but we talk about, you know, the knockoff era of the slasher knockoffs. And most of them really were knockoffs. Most of them were following a formula. This movie, just say what you will, Golan Globus said, fuck the formula.
Yes.
We're going to do something fucking weird. And they were trying to make something. And this is very indicative of early Golan Globus.
Yeah.
You know, they were trying to, they were people who envisioned themselves as artists, but they were making trash.
Yes.
They were trying to make trash art. And this is very much trash art. This is like, does it work? Not all the time, but what works does work. And while you're watching it, there's no point at this movie where you're watching it and you're like, oh, this is exactly like this movie. No, it's fucking New Year's Evil, and it's its own thing, and there's no other movie that you're going to nail down like it.
And it's specifically, and I can't believe it took us this long to mention the fact that this is a canon film release, and you're right, Golan and Globus' involvement is exactly why this movie doesn't follow formula, because if you look at what happened with the movie Breakin', all they knew is that breakdancing was popular. They knew nothing about it at all.
No.
So when they made...
They were two Israeli guys.
So when they made Breakin', it was just like, we need to make a movie about breakdancing. What does it need to be about? How does that work? I don't know. Just fucking make it. That's exactly... They basically looked around and said, slasher movies are huge. Let's make a slasher movie. How do you make a slasher movie? I don't know. Just fucking do it. And that's why we get New Year's Evil. And why it completely breaks the mold is because nobody working on this film had any idea what the fucking mold was in the first place. And accidentally created something very unique in New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve.
Which, of course, I need to tell a couple of quick stories.
Oh, my. So Brian throws a party every year.
Yes, I do.
And it involves a sport. There are two sports involved. The first sport is Brian drinks.
Yeah. It's the end of the fucking world.
Like it's the end of the world. Like it's rapture is coming after midnight. And then sometime before midnight, Brian passes out.
And I want to point out that this will be the sixth one this year. What he's talking about has only happened like four of the six times.
Four of the six times.
Yeah, that's pretty good average.
Maybe, but
pretty good average.
It's happened four of the six times, but the sixth one hasn't happened yet. So it's happened four of the five times in which I participate in the great sport of Brian tossing, in which
don't
it's
you
my
throw
job
math in my face
to help pick you up off the floor, clean up whatever you vomited on, roll you onto your side so you don't choke to death on your own vomit, and then deal with whatever fallout happens.
Like a rock star, baby. Like a fucking rock star. And I will say that, you know, in years past, there have been situations like playing slap shots for hours, which,
yeah,
you know, resulted in like red spots on my face the next day.
Which was not nearly as bad as the worst sport of all time.
Well, I'll get there. And then there was, what was the thing that happened? Oh, turning my entire living room into a pillow and blanket fort.
Yes,
that also happened.
That was the thing that happened.
And then, of course, the creme de la creme of terrible ideas.
Oh, yes.
Was
Brian for Loco Hands.
Here's the thing you need to understand about me. When it comes to alcohol, I become Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future. I am the Marty McFly of drinking.
You like do all the lines on the table and then get Parkinson's?
Wow. No, I was referring more to the I can't let them think I'm chicken.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the reality of the situation.
Wow. And not- wow, I don't feel so bad about what I've done on New Year's, man.
No. So he, one night...
I was challenged.
He was challenged by another Brian Kelly, a good buddy of ours.
To a game of Edward 40 Hands, which if you're not familiar with the game, is you take two 40s of beer and you tape them with duct tape to your hands and they do not get removed until you drink both of them.
However, in just a few months prior, Four Loko had been banned.
Because it was killing frat boys across the nation.
Because it was killing frat boys across the nation. And so a bunch of our friends, especially several King hipsters in town, went out before it was banned and bought up everything they could. So
yes,
you had a stash of Four Loko.
The OG FDA, like, removed,
yes,
Four Loko. Yeah.
And you guys each taped a Four Loko to your hands.
Yeah.
And you both killed both Four Lokos. The big, tall 24-ounce cans.
Of the worst flavors, too, if that's even a thing that exists. But I remember my last thought, as I had finished both of them and were slowly taking the duct tape off my hands, I was excited because, and this is the last thought I had, wow, I'm not even that drunk. Because the rest of the sentence didn't even come out before I woke up the next day on a dog bed.
Yes, but in the interim, you made out with a metal RoboCop poster.
And again, but what he's telling you right now is exactly how I heard about all this, completely secondhand. I made out with a metal RoboCop poster. I started sexy dancing when I put on a VHS copy of Raw Deal. I fell into a laundry room door and broke it. I burned my hand on somebody's cigarette. I started a fight with somebody else because they were messing with me, like, yeah, the Patriots are pretty good at basketball. And I was just like, I don't even know how many ways to tell you you're wrong. And I just started screaming.
And invariably at some point in the night on New Year's Eve, somebody taps me on the shoulder and says, Cargill, it's time.
It's and time for the Brian time. Tossing.
And it becomes Brian tossing time. The first time it was one of those, hey, man, I'm here for you. Let's, you know, don't worry about it. It's cool. Let's take care of him. He just had a little too much to drink. And then by the fourth time it happened, it's just like, it's time. It's like, okay, all right, let's go take care of Brian.
But, you know, like there was one year where I passed out on the bathroom floor and somebody made the suggestion of putting me in the bathtub and I got irrationally, I remember this moment. I got irrationally afraid that they were going to murder me because I watched too many horror movies. And drunk Brian thinks if somebody puts you in a bathtub, they're going to pour lye on your ass and they're going to disintegrate your body parts so they can eat more. So I refused to get in the bathtub.
They just
didn't want
to have to mop up anything. They could just shower it off.
I refused to get in that bathtub. And that is exactly why, dear listeners, that this week's junk food pairing is absolutely Four Loko.
Oh, of course it is. God bless you for that.
It is the culprit behind my most infamous New Year's Evil story and a drink that perfectly sums up this film. It's an irresponsible combination of ingredients that don't work well together. It makes you feel like...
Oh, like us.
Like us, new waivers, truck hat wearers, and punks. And it makes you feel like you've gone completely mental, and I can't seem to stay away from it. And that, my friends, in a nutshell, is the connection between Four Loko and New Year's Evil, a film that is on Netflix right now streaming. You should definitely check out.
And Amazon Prime.
And this year, by the way, I just want to point out that... it's the sixth New Year's Evil that I've thrown, so it's New Year's Evil 666, so we're throwing a Halloween party in December because I fucking love Halloween, and I love that I get to throw a second Halloween party in 1 year. Makes me very happy.
And I'm sure I'll get the tap on the arm from your brother, and it's like, Cargill, it's time.
And I promise you that if you want to toss me in the bathtub, I will be marginally convinced that you're not trying to kill me.
You say that now.
I do say. I'm going to say a lot of things now.
But drunk Brian is a very different person than regular Brian.
Drunk Brian starts out as like the loudest, huggiest, like,
yes,
nostalgic.
Does.
And then just
then there's this 10-minute window before you pass out where you become drunk.
Oh, let's not put that on the mic. let's not put that on air. I censored that last part out. That's what that beep was for.
Yeah, we beeped that. Okay, yeah. So there's a certain level of drunk that he becomes.
Let's just pretend that he said something really vulgar and not just a private joke that I would rather not have spoken on the air. That's what we're going to pretend happened, is he just said the worst thing imaginable, even worse than his Michael J. Fox comment, and that's why we had to beep it out.
Oh, the age is something. No one really knows the words.
One terrifying night of unspeakable evil. New Year's Evil.
Well, before we go, we have a little bit of time. Cargill, this is the end of our first year of Junk Food Cinema. What have been some of your favorite moments thus far of Junk Food Cinema?
Well, you know, we've had so many moments.
Nobody died. This isn't a eulogy. Just get to it.
No, you know, do we have a better moment than hanging out in a hotel room
with Dick Miller? That's a good question.
I mean, it was like, we've had a bunch of moments where we've hung out in, you know, sweaty rooms drinking beer while sweat is dripping off our balls, trying to pretend, you know, recording in them because we can't turn on the AC. There's been so many wonderful ups and downs this year, but the Dick Miller moment is awesome. I loved McGenre Hay.
Of course, man.
McGenre Hay was a lot of fun. And I also really loved our sci-fi comedy send-up, you know, watching those and just sitting and sharing those with each other. Those are probably some of my very favorites. But you know what? When all is said and done, I got to go back to I loved being able to sit around and talk about Battle Truck.
Oh, of course.
Battle Truck, for fuck's sake.
Way back in the first. I mean, yeah, absolutely interviewing Dick Miller. I really like being able to do our live show at Convergence.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. And I was really happy, you know, just a couple days ago when we ended up on a Nerdist list of like podcasts you should check out. And then you told me a story. You don't have to mention any names. But you told me a story about some filmmakers that you ran into.
Along
your trip that actually liked the show.
Yeah, no, and you know, I don't talk about it much on the show, but you know, I'm a professional novelist and a professional screenwriter, and so you know, I went to London in particular to spend a week hanging out with, you know, fantasy writers at WorldCon, science fiction and fantasy writers, and then spend, you know, most of a week hanging out with horror filmmakers. And during that time, you know, I have people walk up to me and they're like, oh, hey, I read your book, or oh, hey, I saw your movie, or oh, hey, you're working on this thing and I'm really excited, or hey, I knew your reviews. And this is the first time where I had a filmmaker walk up and go, hey, you're Cargill. And I said, yeah. And he goes, you do Junk Food Cinema. And I was like, well, yeah. And he goes, oh, I'm a big fan of the podcast. And I just immediately pull up my phone. I'm like, Brian, you're there, somebody digs the podcast.
People listen to the show.
And it was somebody whose movie I was like, oh, well, I have to go see your movie now. And then the movie was really great. And it was like, oh, thank God. But it was awesome. You know, it was the first time somebody had walked up to me and said, oh, I'm digging on Junk Food Cinema. And I was like, oh, Brian, can't wait to hear that. And I told him that, and he was like, oh, tell Brian, Brian's great. And so it was, you know, that was a really cool moment. I didn't want to bring that up because it was, it was really cool to have somebody, and the fact that, and this is our chance now to, since we're going to break the fourth wall a little bit and pretend that there's somebody else in this conversation,
sure,
aside from us, because really this seems like it's a podcast. It's a conversation between two guys, but it's a conversation between three of us. It's me, it's Brian, and it's you. And so though many of you have stuck with us from the beginning of this podcast, and some of you, you know, followed us on Spill, or followed Brian from One of Us, or followed me from Ain't It Cool News, or any of the other things. But however you got here, thank you for sticking it out with
Definitely.
Us. Me and Brian, really, I mean, it was one of those things that Brian just asked me to do this, and I was like, I love sitting around and drinking beers and talking about movies with Brian, so why not do that with a microphone involved and
let other people hear it.
And let other people hear it. And that's really the only reason I do this. And it's always worth taking the time out in any given week or any given month to just come over to your place, or come over to, you know, we're at Rock Sauce Studios, mm-hmm. and bring over a six pack and just knock back a few beers and talk about these movies that when you bring up at parties, everyone else just kind of looks at you like, really?
Yeah.
What is Battle Truck? And it's like, oh, and you tell them about it. Like, you got to watch it. You know, they're not going to fucking watch it. And you guys, many of you fucking watch it. I get your tweets. I get your Facebook posts. And I love that you guys are digging into this stuff and taking the chance on a lot of these movies. So thank you so much for being here with us and being listeners and just being awesome and being a very supportive community. And you guys have been really great. And thank you.
Could not agree more. And I will tell you, we've got some really fun stuff on deck for 2015. A lot more great series that we're going to do. And I'm just looking forward to
Black History Month.
Blaxploitation History Month.
We're doing. Well, I don't.
No, that's what I called it when I did the written version of Junk Food Cinema, because I would always focus on blaxploitation. But we're expanding that out a little bit this year.
Number of actors who we've wanted to do episodes on, who are some of our deep fried favorites, and it was just one of those things where do we put that in? And then we're like, hey, Black History Month is coming up. We can talk about all these really great actors that everybody else ignores, who are fucking awesome. And that's the one I'm really excited about right now, because we're gonna talk. I won't drop the names now, but there's going to be some people where we're gonna say the name and you're gonna be like, who is that? And then we're gonna mention it and start mentioning the movies, and you're gonna go, holy fuck, I know who that is. That dude's awesome. Yeah. That's who that is. And then and they've got such great bodies of work, so we can't talk about that. And one of them is somebody we've been talking about doing since the beginning of this show, and we just haven't made it work yet.
Yeah.
And it's gonna fucking happen now. So I am so excited about February.
So of course, take your drink, as you always do whenever we talk about shows we're going to do, talking about Junk Food Cinema future. But if you wanted to catch up on Junk Food Cinema past, definitely check us out on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And be sure to use our Amazon links. Like I said, this movie that we talked about this week is readily available on Amazon as well as on Netflix. But if you want to make some different Amazon purchases, just go ahead and click on that link anyway, because once you get there via that link, anything you buy benefits us. We really do appreciate that. And Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me on twitter.com/massaworm, MASSAWYRM, or on facebook.com/massaworm.
Awesome. And you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And please do check out oneofus.net, which is my home away from home. A lot of podcasts and blogs over there that I'm very proud of. So definitely check that out. And we'll be back this time, same bad channel next year. So for Cargo, this is Brian. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you junkies next year.
Happy New Year!